worry me personally, and for which I'm not sure there are any straightforward solutions. Can compensation really be meaningful? What are the main practicalities against the idealism which many of us have fought? Secondly, is it not extremely dangerous to raise the emotional high hopes of survivors which can never be fulfilled? Modest lifetime pensions are a limited measure of justice. Should we consider compensation really for descendants of survivors for personal suffering or injury? Fourthly, where do we draw the lines between relief, welfare, and compensation? If one looks at the major concentration camps all over the world, which were liberated after the Second World War, thousands of people died in the first few days in each one because of inappropriate food or no food at all. How should this be dealt with? Are funds from relief organizations really sufficient and well organized? My fifth point, how can a political priority be given nationally and internationally to fund reparations between states for economic damages and property institution and compensation for the individual for personal suffering or injury? How does one promote this concept to different countries? Is it not a low priority compared, for example, to climate change or armaments? Is it possible to change attitudes and therefore ultimately governments to help with this on a large scale, in addition to the various UN resolutions already in place, which have been accepted also into their domestic law? All NGOs like Human Rights Watch need to continue to promote this internationally and nationally. What is the impact of an invasion for liberalizing a genocidal regime? How can it become accountable and responsible, if at all, in dealing with the victims? Can this be done on an international basis? Who should be responsible, my seventh point, for transferring victims to new countries where they can settle peacefully with the support of other people who are already there, perhaps of the same ethnic or religious background? The High Commissioner for Human Rights and the International Organization for Migration play an important role here, but are not yet acknowledged by everyone, for some reason, as an integral part of a liberating force. Stateless refugees remain a problem. My final point, legal agreements can only function if they can be implemented. To what extent have we failed to implement our legal skills in those countries where genocide takes place? Is there any way in which the world community can strengthen these? Economic sanctions do not seem to work, but often make life worse for the victims. War is usually a catastrophe. What else can be done? Brutal, cruel fanatics destroy or maim innocent people. The UN protocols on the prevention and punishment of the crimes of genocide have not stopped this. The right to remedy and reparation for victims of gross violations of international human rights and serious violations of international humanitarian law was only established as a principle in October 2005. It seems to me an absolute scandal that it has taken so long for this recommendation to be able to come to the third committee of the UN on its 60th anniversary for approval. This declaration itself is slightly ambiguous, but at least it is an attempt to underpin what many of us have been fighting for generations. René Cassin, who drafted the Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, would have been horrified if he had known how long this would take to be adopted by the UN. Cassin was a French Jew. If the world Jewish community had, for example, not taken it into its own hands to care for the victims left alive after the Holocaust, they would have continued to rot in the stench-infested displacement persons camps we have found, and found no haven whatsoever to survive, grow, and develop. No one else was there to help. How did they manage alone, without the UN, to achieve negotiations? Property restitution was a concept which the Western Allies already agreed to in 1947. This helped the later arguments of the world Jewish community, especially through four major international Jewish organizations based in the United States. The military government of the Soviet Union was, however, never interested in this or in any other concept for help. You perhaps recollect that in 1949 there was a vacuum in the former Third Reich, which was then controlled by the four allies. The Western allies supported the concept which the Jewish community presented to them on their own views of the previous agreements. The Jewish community then set up a conference on Jewish material claims against Germany, with a leading personality of that time, Nahum Goldman, chairman of the Jewish Agency, an organization representing Jews worldwide, who had been educated in Heidelberg in Germany. He understood Konrad Adenauer, who had befriended him when he was mayor of Cologne and before he became chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany. They both agreed that the new Germany could never possibly be accepted by other nations as an equal partner unless it did something for the monstrous, horrific bestialities deliberately perpetrated by the Third Reich. Adenauer was a deeply sincere Catholic who strongly felt that it had to be dealt with from a moral point of view, first and foremost. But of course he was mindful of the agreement of the Western allies to this, with whom he had to negotiate on many other matters. He persuaded the newly formed Federal Republic of Germany that there was an obligation and it must be dealt with. The voluntary agreements for compensation for the three parties in Luxembourg culminated from these discussions in 1952 between the Claims Conference, the Federal Republic of Germany, and the newly formed State of Israel in 1948. It was a remarkable achievement. We should remember that neither of the countries nor the Claims Conference, who were all there sitting around the table, had existed during the Third Reich period. The legislation which was enacted from this covers many volumes. The complex agreements were divided into two groups: those with the State of Israel, newly created by the UN, and those outside Israel, to help with the reconstruction of Jewish communities which had nearly entirely been destroyed. The agreements from the State of Israel were more complex. Funds were given over 12 years for infrastructure, building, and goods, all to come from Germany, to help Israel absorb the refugees from the policies of the Third Reich. The plea for this was from Israel in 1951 and was ignored by the Soviet Union. The Americans, the UK, and France supported it. Since then, there have been many additional agreements with the Federal Republic of Germany. The highly complex individual agreements cover healthcare, compensation for slave workers, compensation for loss of assets, including art, insurance, and many other items which gradually evolved from the initial agreements. There were later extended, these agreements were later extended to Austria. I can't possibly highlight all the work which covered the difficult, complex negotiations, but I thought four of the principal categories might give you some idea. Firstly, there were the international bilateral treaties and agreements, and subsequently there were specially funded German programs for people who had suffered living in the West. Later, an agreement was signed which dealt with the former German Democratic Republic after its collapse. It was a remarkable agreement, supported by the Federal Republic of Germany. There are various pacts with the American government, as well as with other countries and the Claims Conference. The second category covered multilateral agreements between governments, industry, and various parties representing victims and heirs. Among the governments were the German, Polish, and Russian. The German Foundation in 2000 was created to compensate former slave and forced laborers, not only from Germany, but also from all parts of Europe, occupied by the Third Reich on a 50-50 basis between industry and government. Both had been responsible for collecting and using these laborers. Many of these came from Eastern Europe. Thirdly, there were the 1998 collective bank settlements with Switzerland. These were extremely complex agreements which had been settled. And the last category I've put down is covered other specialist parties dealing with insurance and similar matters. Many victims had life insurances in different European countries, and it was felt strongly that the insurance companies needed to honour their liabilities for both the insured and their descendants, especially the children and grandchildren of those exterminated. The five major insurance companies of Europe were deeply involved with these agreements. Over its many years, $60 billion, not 42, has ultimately been paid out for personal injury and suffering and personal pensions for all requests received by 1969, when these agreements were closed with the Federal Republic. Payments for individuals who lived or were living in the German Democratic Republic were negotiated after its collapse. These included communal and private property belonging to Jewish families, which were then restituted, or where heirs were given to the Claims Conference for its welfare and educational work worldwide. Many descendants were found in nearly 40 countries. The endless court cases and lawyers appointed to work with these problems belies imagination. In the 1970s, after the Helsinki agreements, the Soviets finally allowed Jews to emigrate. Among them were those who had been in concentration camps in the USSR or had gone eastward at the end of the war. The Federal Republic finally in 1980 agreed to create a new hardship fund for these refugees, but this time the funds were to be administered as one-time payments by the Claims Conference for the first time. The Nazis persecuted people everywhere, as well as North Africa. We're still in discussions with them about the North African continent. The former slave and forced labor funds compensation agreement really fits into my second category of multilateral ones. The amounts received were extremely small, but nevertheless appreciated as an acknowledgement of their suffering. The German Foundation, for example, was especially created for some of these and was one of these. The difference between a slave worker and a forced laborer was defined by the Third Reich. A slave worker was to be worked to death within 6 months, whereas a forced laborer was able to continue to work where he had been sent to during the period of the Third Reich. Forced laborers came from all the countries occupied by Germany. The agreements covered slave workers like the Roma and Sinti as well. Payments were higher for the former slave workers than for forced laborers. I could go on at length about many of the other compensation funds, but I thought you would be interested to hear something about the complexity of running and administering these funds. conversations with victims are monitored. They often inquire if they're entitled to claim in one way or another. All this information is fed into our computers, and very often relatives, for the first time since the war, suddenly appear in other countries, and movingly, the claims conference can link these people together again. They had hitherto been lost to one another. Claims have to be coordinated with all potential recipients, especially for property. There are many groups of young people who carry out this wonderful work in the United States, Israel, and Germany, telephoning with the victims in different languages. It's very complicated. Many of the victims speak unclearly, and sometimes, for example, the spelling of the name of a concentration camp is made in completely different ways. The word Auschwitz, amazingly enough, has been spelled in 700 different ways. The database of victims is extremely valuable, and the analysis of this has helped enormously in negotiating new claims for many. It also helps the German Austrian governments to analyze what they need to do. The New York computers recently processed in 1 year 280,000 claims in 8 languages, an average of 8,500 telephone calls, 1,200 letters, and 1,000 emails from survivors and families were sent and received every week for 1 year. The claims conference has 500 Holocaust-related archives today, scattered in 29 countries around the world, which had to be documented for settlements. All these funds needed to be negotiated in great detail to show the specific requirements for victims to be eligible. The criteria for the settlements were often narrow and restrictive. The claims conference was not in a position to deviate from the agreements made with Germany or other countries. They needed desperately to agree to settle claims whilst beneficiaries were still alive, even if they were not ideal. In some cases, the Germans have changed agreements after many years of negotiation to make them fairer. For example, no person who had not been 6 months in a concentration camp was eligible for compensation. The majority were already dead after 6 months. It was a miracle that any survived. Other funds were later created for those in ghettos and for several other categories of suffering. I think you can see from my description how important it is to have a government or a public agency able to create and organize settlements as well for genocides. How did the claims conference cope to find survivors? 4 major areas give a simplified explanation. They had to identify eligible survivors. They had to mail applications to those who have received previous compensation and who might be eligible for additional funds in respect of, for example, slave labor. They made a massive international media advertising campaign worldwide, which drew attention when a new fund was available. And lastly, 350 social service agencies, as well as survivor organizations around the world, assisted claimants with these complicated applications. Every new application from a survivor is digitally scanned with linkages with offices in New York, Tel Aviv, Frankfurt, and Budapest. The database from these permitted unlimited information input, storage, and retrieval, whilst allowing staff to trace the progress of claims. They were further electronically sorted and analyzed to identify and group them for streamlined procedures. This sophisticated computerization system was the key to this most pressing and imperative challenge faced by us. It revealed much of the history of persecution, which was previously unknown. It led not only to the restitution of a little money for each victim, but the restitution of history, which the 2 previous speakers have highlighted as so important. In the case, for example, of medical experiments for women, there were 195 procedures in the 32 different camps dealing with medical experiments. Only after painful efforts by elderly survivors reluctantly submitting applications was this really known. Nothing can express the torments endured by these victims when filling in these forms. They were reminded of their previous horrific experiences. The experiments are beyond human imagination. The poor people endure the most terrible traumas again. This was one of the many complex conflicts in dealing with this of our organization. There are many other claims which still need to be sorted out throughout Europe, particularly in Bulgaria, Poland and Romania. In March this year, we held a conference at the International Criminal Court in the Peace Palace in The Hague with over 80 genocide victim organizations from different countries participating. The objective of this conference was to highlight what had been done by the Claims Conference and how their experiences could be of benefit to victims elsewhere. It was a deeply moving conference, and many of the genocide victim countries' leaders were encouraged that people outside their territories deeply cared about their problems. It was also very moving for us to see that some of our experiences could be applied elsewhere. I could go into many details about this conference, but what it highlighted firstly, above all, was the urgent need to create a database in each area of conflict which could be used later for negotiations. Secondly, each country should study who were or are their most important neighbours or trading partners who could be induced to help and support them. It was also essential to avoid any form of corruption. The conference we held in Chester last week was created as we saw an urgent need for new limbs and plastic surgery for victims of the most horrific bestiality in countries such as Sierra Leone and North Uganda to begin with. Some of the trusts we introduced to the executive director of the ICC Victim Support Group were very helpful in backing his ideas to obtain funds for voluntary young surgeons, we now have about 30 in North Uganda, and plastic surgeons. This work is now in progress. In fact, after the Chester conference, we got from the International Red Cross, who came to our conference, a guarantee that they would supply free all the new polypropylene limbs for the needs of these victims. The main problem is not only creating new limbs, however, plastic surgery for victims, but also ensuring that their families and communities know how to care for them, especially aftercare. There are already some very good schools in training people in Tanzania and in Iraq, among others. But an enormous amount of work needs to be done for training centers throughout the genocidal areas of the world to make sure that there is support for these poor people who have lost a limb, a nose, or an ear. It is a tragedy that despite the Declaration of Human Rights, which this month celebrates its 60th year of existence, in many countries we still have enormous deprivation of rights for so many people, let alone the horrific victims of which we have spoken. This year it should perhaps be better not to celebrate it. The world community has failed to implement the genocide conventions, and punishment for crimes of genocide have just not worked since the conventions of 1949 in a way which reduces the horrors appearing all over the place. Leaders of certain countries flagrantly disregard any legal agreements into which they have entered with the United Nations or other parties. All nations are responsible for trying to stop the initiation of genocides, and where they do occur, for stopping them.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have, we're just a few minutes over, and I'm conscious that we're to have a refreshment break where we'll have some more highly useful exchanges. But nonetheless, if you would bear with us, I think we should just take the opportunity. I would allow two questions, if there are questions to be asked. Yes, please.
I suppose by two questions, you mean...
Two persons asking questions, yes.
Professor Shelton, I enjoyed your presentation and found it extremely stimulating. I need to ask you two or three questions.
If you can keep it brief, really, because we have to...
Yes. If you were part of the President Obama team, how might you advise him to tackle reparations for slavery? Secondly, what is white America's prevailing attitude towards reparations for slavery? Thirdly, what role do you think referenda might play as part and parcel of the political or social struggle or approach to gaining reparations?
Okay, thank you.
There's a last one. This is very important. What do you understand of the term continuing harm? That's what we've done.
Okay, thank you. Was there anyone else who would like to pose a question perhaps to Mr. Nathan? Yes.
Thank you. It's just a brief question. First of all, I just want to make the comment that even though there has been all these reparations afforded by Germany, they still say there wasn't a legal obligation but a moral obligation to do it. And taking this into account, I'm just wondering whether litigation is really the best tool to move forward and to remedy the past, which is a bit of the issue in this conference. At the end of the day, litigation is a tool that works for the educated, for the privileged, and it's quite confined what the results you can get. And I do understand that litigation can, it's a way of sparking movement, and there can be other political consequences, etc. But I just wonder whether, of course it depends on who the victim is and what the victim can use and then obtain results. Is there any other option apart from litigation that can be used within the reparation framework that can be more convenient for this massive violations and of course past violations, which is more complicated in the legal sense?
Okay, thank you. Who wants to go first? Okay, Mr. Mayor.
I think what I hope came over in my talk to you, that everything was done with the agreement of both parties, that the litigation was only to settle the terms of the principles which were agreed voluntarily. All the agreements, including the Swiss bank settlements, ended up with voluntary agreements by both parties. But that doesn't mean that arms were not twisted. And in many cases, the success came about really because there was another party involved who could put pressure on another country. And I believe that the only way we discussed at length in The Hague and in New York with the head of the claims, the ICC, if you have a genocide somewhere and you want to settle something, you need to find powerful partners who can be induced to do something, otherwise you are lost. And if those powerful partners are induced to do something, then sometimes you can succeed. And I mean, I can't try and think of a good case, but if you take the Congo, about which I know absolutely nothing, there are many people who are interested in the Congo, who have commercial interests. Some have exploited it beyond belief. Some of those countries could possibly be induced that they have to do something in order that they would be respected again to help stop the nightmare. There are now 5 million dead in the Congo. I heard last week from the ICC from these awful wars. Now, someone, some nations could do something. The UN is still hopeless in getting a rapid settlement of these things. That's my personal view. The UN can't act quickly because it is not a priority for all the countries in the UN. After all, the UN is only an umbrella for all the nations of the world, and all the people who are there have other priorities where they want to arrange something which gives a benefit to their country in 2 or 3 years. They can't look long term. And so all long term things, even climate change, took years to do, although it's in the interest of everybody. But settling reparations is very difficult unless you have a good partner. The claims conference strongest partner was, of course, the United States of America. And that was because they were the most powerful ally at that time in Germany. And all our meetings with the State Department still uphold the policy in America to back the claims conference. And similarly, you need strong people like the State Department elsewhere to remind people that it's in their interest to do something.
Thank you. Professor Shaw?
Well, that gave me time to draft a pretty long wish list of what I'd like to see happen. Let me start domestically first. And I would say that I hope the rumor is true that Colin Powell will be the Secretary of Education, because I think one step in reparations is a really comprehensive support for inner city schooling. No Child Left Behind morphed into No CEO Left Behind with the current administration. And I think that education has got to be a focus. That means more scholarships for minority students going to universities, but it's got to start at the preschool and primary school level. Secondly, pass the comprehensive health bill, because we've got tremendous problems with uninsured medical expenses in the African-American community. Third, get those 3 new Supreme Court justices, which we're expecting, to reaffirm affirmative action. It's been being cut back little by little. And I think affirmative action is a very good form of reparations, and I think it needs to continue. There should be funding, I think, coming out of the national government for the African American Museum, the Slavery Museum, which has been approved. It just hasn't been designed or built yet. I would rename the Reagan National Airport the Frederick Douglass National Airport. And I would pass legislation to abolish predatory lending to minority persons. We have these corner check cashing places that will cash your paycheck before you get it and take 20% off the top. And it leads to this enduring cycle of poverty. And I think more and more we have to look at some of these issues in class terms and in poverty terms. That's on the domestic level. On the foreign policy level, I think we need to get into the Doha round and abolish agricultural subsidies. That is the main thing we could do right now to assist African countries. And I think the administration should be constructive and participatory in the second Durban conference in Geneva next year. So those are just a few things there. In terms of what whites think, you know, it would vary so much from throughout the United States, and I think be very linked to educational levels. I read a horrifying statistic that 1 in 4 Americans, without regard to ethnicity, color, or whatever, do not complete high school. Now, that makes employment for them very difficult. They're all competing for a shrinking job market, and it does breed inter-community hostilities. I think among gays right now, there's a real backlash because of the result, and this is linked to your third question on referenda. Proposition 8, you may or may not have heard of, was on the ballot in California. It was a voter initiative measure, a referendum, on whether gay marriages should continue to be legal in California. It was defeated by a very small percentage, but 70% of African Americans voted to repeal the gay marriage bill. And so right now, the gay and lesbian community is wondering, you know, have the oppressed turned into the oppressor? And so there's really some, I think, some communication that needs to go on there. Defining continuing harm, we can certainly look at the disparity in income and wealth levels between minorities and the white community as one measure of the continuing harm. And I think that's a statistic that can be looked at. Life expectancy, infant mortality, maternal mortality. There's a wide range of indicators, I think, that could be used to define continuing harm and could also be a measure of further reparations.
Well, it's always good to have Diana Sheldon here, not short of ideas. Just before we go on break, perhaps just allow me one thought, thinking about cases that I've been involved in specifically, and still am involved in Iraq, because I'm quite troubled, actually, by the question of Gabriella. Not by your question, but by the consequences or the implications of it. From a human rights law perspective, of course, there is a right to a remedy, and there is a right to a remedy, including for ongoing effects past violations. And that raises a question, if we're really saying here, and we've heard it from perspective of political sociology and from law, and certainly from the real politics of a real case, that if you're able to mobilize and you've got powerful friends and representation in places, you've got a good chance of success. But apparently if you're not, then apparently you have a poor chance of success, which really raises a question, what are these inalienable human rights we're speaking about, including to a remedy? Now, I would think that exactly the inverse should be so from a human rights law perspective in terms of protection of affected and vulnerable persons, that they exactly who do not enjoy powerful friends, special representation or whatever, should be the ones that we should focus on. And I'm specifically thinking of two groups in an Iraq context who were subject to genocide or genocidal, as we called it at the time, effects. One is the Kurds, whose self-defining identity is under the phrase that we have no friends but the mountains. They are pretty much disliked by everybody. Hard to find friends. Now, they have some friends at the moment in the United States of America, but they have proven in the past to be fickle friends. And so we might watch what that would actually come to. And I'm thinking even worse in the case of the Marsh Arabs, who really, really have no friends anywhere and are really on the verge of probably having not only suffered genocide in the sense of at least the destruction of as a people's, but probably with little hope of ever the resurrection of the environment and the context which defines them as a people. So that's very troubling, and I would hope that it's not the conclusion of this conference that all that we really need is powerful friends and specific representation, but as a matter of human rights, inalienable, universal human rights, we might look at the responsibility and a public interest to act on behalf of those who have actually suffered. My 2 cents worth, sorry. I guess we get a cup of coffee and something sweet now, right? So we come back at in about 15, 20 minutes. 20 minutes, shall we?